Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A series of high-profile attacks this week has shattered the relative calm in Iraq. The latest was today when back-to-back suicide bombings killed at least 60 people outside the most important Shiite shrine in Baghdad. That follows two bombings in separate parts of Iraq yesterday that killed more than 80 people. The violence is raising questions about the Iraqi security forces as American troops scale back before a full withdrawal in 2011. Jim Muir of the BBC has been following this story, and he joins us from Baghdad. And Jim, can you start by telling us about today's attacks? What happened?
Well, these latest attacks, apparently, according to the bomb squad chief, it was two women who were carrying bombs concealed in their handbags, but they were also holding grenades in their hands, hand grenades, which they took the pins out of, detonating the grenades and the bigger charges they were carrying too. Apparently, these attacks taking place at the two main gates, the main entrances into the shrine area. So really high death tolls, 60 killed at least, including 25 Iranian pilgrims who were at these Shiite shrines. And, of course, just on Thursday, we had more than 50 Iranian pilgrims killed on the main road between the Iranian border and Baghdad when a suicide bomber walked into a restaurant and blew it up. So the Iranians, of course, fellow Shiites with the Iraqi Shiite community, paying a very high price for their faith.
Are Iranians a target here?
Certainly in the Thursday bombing, yes, because the wayside restaurant where they stopped off is known to be a place where Iranian pilgrims coming in on that main road from the Iranian border would be likely to be found, as indeed they were.
Do we know who's responsible? Same groups Thursday and Friday?
Well, of course, we don't get responsibility claims or anything like that after these attacks, but certainly I think there would be little doubt in the minds of most people that these would be attributable to Sunni militant groups in the line of al-Qaeda, if not actually al-Qaeda itself, and the aim of, number one, to undermine the security situation, but also to trigger off or to inflame sectarian passions. It's exactly this kind of attack that helped trigger that really deadly cycle of sectarian violence in 2006 and 2007, which proved so hard to bring under control and which took many thousands, uncounted thousands of lives.
You know, an Iraqi military spokesperson says that some of the folks in charge of security, there will be action taken against them because of the security failure. Do you think that this is an isolated incident, or does it raise questions about the ability of Iraqi security forces to handle things?
Well, I think it raises a huge number of questions, but one of the answers it provokes is that it is very hard to stop women suicide bombers. There's a cultural sensitivity about searching women, and of course they tend to wear these long black voluminous cloaks which cover up a lot of things. So a lot of the suicide attacks recently, including some of the most deadly ones, have been carried out by women. But yes, beyond that, it does raise questions about the capabilities of the Iraqi security forces. With this kind of thing happening in the capital, people are beginning to wonder whether it should be added to the list of places such as Mosul in the north, Barkuba just to the north of Baghdad, which the Americans are considering staying on in after the end of June when they're supposed to be out of all Iraqi cities. There are questions. Are the Iraqis capable of holding the line, or could we see an even worse situation developing than has been hinted at by the last 2 days?
You know, this week, Iraqi security officials said they captured Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, the head of an al-Qaeda-linked group known as the Islamic State of Iraq. There have been false reports about his capture in the past. How significant would it be if he actually was in custody?
I frankly don't think it would turn any particular tide. And in fact, so I have to say, some American commanders even cast doubt on whether this man exists. He is so shadowy that some suspect he may be actually more or less a kind of virtual creation, an internet creation, to put an Iraqi face on what is a foreign, they believe, phenomenon of al-Qaeda leaders coming from outside and creating local cells here. So I personally would doubt very much that even if he has been captured, and that's been very far from being verified at this point, that it would make much difference. After all, Abu Musab Zarqawi, for example, 2 years ago, the undoubted commander of al-Qaeda in Iraq, was killed, and that made really very little difference to the course of events on the ground. So it might be a blow, but it's definitely not a death one.
Yeah, violence has been at its lowest level in Iraq since the American invasion in 2003. How would you describe people's sense of the security situation there?
In Baghdad, it is really hard to get things in perspective because you go out into the streets and they are thronged with people. There's no comparison between the situation now and the situation 2 years ago when the streets were deserted at night, people were fearful, huddled in their darkened homes and so on. Now you go out in the streets 8, 9, 10 o'clock at an evening, you get stuck in traffic jams. The question raised by the last 2 days is this a trend now, and are people going to have to go back to the old bad days, or is it a blip on the screen which can't be sustained, just a spectacular once or twice off? That question obviously we can't answer, but people will be looking out for that very, very keenly indeed.
The BBC's Jim Muir talking with us from Baghdad. Thanks very much for being with us.
Most welcome, Deborah.
And now for a major change of pace, we turn to food. We've all heard the expression, you are what you eat. Well, our next guest, Jeffrey Mason, goes beyond that. As he sees it, what's on our plate is connected to not only our physical health, but our moral, emotional, even our environmental health. Jeffrey Mason's new book is titled The Face on Your Plate, The Truth About Food. He's a former psychoanalyst who's been writing about animals since the 1990s. His latest book puts together statistics, some of them alarming, from scientific and government reports, and those numbers suggest that the way we eat is causing big problems. And Jeffrey, you became a vegan. You eat no animal products because you were concerned about the suffering of animals, and you feel that animals have feelings like people do. And now you're concerned about the environmental effects of consuming animal products. Can you give me an example?
A lot of the forests that are being cut down in the Amazon, for example, this is in order to grow soy to feed the beef that we eat and that the Chinese eat. So it's becoming a global problem. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they themselves have recommended that people have got to. It's not so much a recommendation as a warning. We must eat less meat.
Let's talk about where seafood fish fall into what you're talking about.
Most of us don't know very much about fish and are not aware of the amazing research that's been coming out in the last couple of years about, for example, the fact that fish feel pain. I mean, we're really just at the beginning of our understanding of fish behavior, fish emotions, fish feelings, fish intelligence, fish memory. This is a brand new field.
So basically, fish would have to be included in the category because they feel pain and because of your empathy for them.
Well, that's right. They suffer. They feel pain. In fact, there's a lot more now known about fish. I mean, we're really just at the beginning of our understanding of fish behavior.
Aside from animals or fish, it's also animal products when you talk about being vegan. And in your book, you mention a trip to a farm in New Zealand where you talk about why you also don't eat any animal products, namely eggs. Can you tell
Yes.
us what's wrong with eggs?
I was lucky in New Zealand and able to get a chicken scientist to get me into one of these places. And I must say it was appalling. They're kept in tiny little cages, six to a cage. There's absolutely no enrichment. They never see the sun. And they last how long? Oh, maximum, I'd say, 2 years. And then they're called a spent hen, and they're just destroyed or sold for pet food. And, of course, all the male chicks that are born are simply killed immediately. Some of them get gassed, but mostly they're just put into this giant machine that just mashes them up. So it's really a horrifying spectacle. And when I asked the scientists who accompanied me, I said, well, would you say that these chickens are leading a good life? They got very upset and said, define good. I said, well, it's really simple to define good. A good life is a life that allows you to exercise all the capacities which you evolved over time. It was a short visit, let me tell you. They got rid of me very quickly. But if you think about it, this is not a life. If anybody tells you that chickens are leading a good life, they're not telling you the truth.
How about cage-free, all of these things that we have now?
Well, you know, cage-free is one of those unregulated terms. It's not like organic. I mean, organic is something that is carefully regulated, but cage-free means whatever you want it to mean.
So, no meat, no fish, no animal products, no eggs, and no honey?
No honey. You know, there are vegans who eat honey, and it's somewhat of a contentious issue among vegans. But my feeling, the reason I don't eat honey is they didn't make it for me. There's no free choice involved. It's not like they get to choose, hey, I'll tell you what, you give me some of your food and I'll give you some of mine. We're not trading here. We're enslaving them. And in America, by and large, the larger companies, rather than have the expense of feeding bees over the winter months, they simply kill them and import new bees in the spring. So that's not, to me, an example of showing gratitude.
But where, you know, you could take this, obviously, even further. So where do you draw the line, I guess,
Tell me how you would take it further.
I mean, could you go to a plant and say, you know, hey, it's violence against broccoli when you chop it down?
There's no evidence, as far as I know, no serious scientific evidence that plants feel pain. You know, it could be that the day may come when we discover, gee, we were really blind about this. And then we would say, well, but we have to live.
I'm wondering how sort of the psychology of all of this comes into play.
People do defend themselves against knowing things that make us uncomfortable or frighten us or traumatize us. So we engage in various mechanisms such as repression. Denial. These are probably the two greatest ones. We do many things. You know, we block out things. We use something known as reversal. But most commonly, we simply don't allow it into our awareness. And you see this with children. Children will sometimes suddenly notice, oh, my God, I'm eating an animal. You know, Dad, why did you call that the leg? Or why did you say past the breast? Or what do you mean by that? You know, and they're really shocked when they discover that they're eating what was once alive being, a sentient being. I think children have the appropriate response and that we've managed to mask this from ourselves by simply not noticing it. You know, interesting, we don't even say a name that means the animal. We tend to say, you know, I'd like a hamburger. Well, that doesn't have any kind of resonance for us. We say even a steak or bacon. None of these are the words that conjure up an image of the actual animal. We don't say pass the pig. Now, we do say that with lamb, which I don't entirely understand, and we do say it with chicken. With chicken, I think it's because people, by and large, don't respect chickens. That is because they don't know them. Of course, if they knew them, they would.
You actually had chickens as pets.
I did. I lived with some chickens because I was writing a book, but I never had lived with a chicken. I had no idea what would be involved. And at first, they were very standoffish. It's like, who are you? You know, we don't want anything to do with you. But slowly, as they realized that I wasn't going to hurt them, they became more intrigued by what I was doing. And in the end, I let them into the house, and they began hanging out with me in my library. Now, the problem with that is you can't housebreak a chicken. So I had to carry around all these wads of Kleenex. And my wife said, that's it. They have to live outside now. Mm-hmm. So I put them outside, and they were furious. They would bang on the door. They would tap on the window. It's like, hey, this is my home, too. Why did you exclude me? I mean, it was amazing how much personality they developed and how much trust they had in me and how affectionate they became. They liked it when I picked them up. They liked to be stroked. They wanted to hang with me. It was wonderful.
That's Jeffrey Mason. We're talking about his new book, The Face on Your Plate, The Truth About Food. When we come back, we'll ask him to connect his interest in human psychology with his thinking about animals. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with author Jeffrey Mason about the ethics of eating meat and animal products. Mason was a Freudian psychoanalyst, and he says we're in denial about how our food choices are harming our health and the health of the planet. And he says we must stop eating meat. And if you think you need to eat meat for protein, Mason says that is a myth. And Jeffrey, before the break, you mentioned how children become horrified when they learn that what they eat was actually a living animal before. But, you know, some people would say that's a simplistic way of looking at things, that adults do things that they have to do sometimes because it's easier, like eating meat.
Sure, but the question is, do we have to? I mean, and I like to turn the question around because I'm so often asked, why don't you eat meat? So now I've started asking in a polite way and out of real curiosity, tell me, why do you eat meat? You know, if they say, well, I do it because it tastes good and I don't really care what happens to the animals, there's not much you can say after that. But if you can engage them and say, well, do you care about your environment? Do you care about your health? Do you care about the conditions under which these animals live before you ate them? It's surprising that you practically find nobody who doesn't acknowledge, yeah, that does concern me. I want to make sure they've had a good life. If you simply ask yourself the simple question of what is it that would make me happy or anybody I care about, and then you try a little thought experiment and say, what would a chicken like, or what would a cow like, or what would a pig like? How do they want to live? If they could choose, what would they choose? And of course, first thing they would choose would be freedom. The second thing, they'd choose to live out the full expanse of their life. They don't want to die years and years before their time is due.
So would you say there's a connection between your psychoanalysis and your interest in animals?
Well, I was trying to think of what is the connection between my interest in psychoanalysis and my interest now in veganism. And I think for me, the linking thread is trauma. I was fascinated for as long as I can remember with trauma and the fact that young children are often traumatized either through physical abuse or sexual abuse. And I thought, well, animals are also traumatized. And children are often traumatized by observing the trauma of animals. You know, I'd heard so often that when a pig is killed, especially a young pig, it makes a horrible sound. It screams, and it sounds like a child being murdered. And nobody likes the sound. And I asked some scientists, some pig scientists who weren't necessarily sympathetic to me, what did they think this was? Is it just a normal cry of an animal in extremis? And they said, no, actually what that is, it's the piglet calling for help. That is what they do. The little pigs squeal in the way that they do as an alarm signal. They're calling for the wild boar and the sow to come to their aid. And it occurred to me that, my God, the trauma of this little pig being slaughtered, calling for help from its parents, and the feelings of horror that it must go through as this is happening. And I realized that to me is identical to what happens to a human child who's being abused. And that was the link. I see this really as a continuum. I also see it as part of my concern with rights. I mean, I'm as passionate about human justice as I am about animal justice. I feel very strongly about racism and homophobia and anti-Semitism and, you know, just the very fact that we all seem to be so wrapped up in our own little tribe, tribalism, you know. We want to kill somebody from a different tribe. I'm always wondering, where does that come from and how can we get away from that? So I do see a continuity. I think my next book will be about the Holocaust. I've always been fascinated. I've been collecting books since I was very young. I have a 2,000-volume library on the Holocaust, and I've always wanted to write something about it.
You actually use quotes referring to some of the things from the Holocaust in this book that I know that were a little startling to me. I think, what is the one quote about all men are Nazis when it comes to animals?
Yeah, Isaac Bashev, a singer, one of my favorite authors, was a Holocaust survivor and a very great writer. And he once said, they asked him, was he a vegetarian for health reasons? He said, yes, for the health of the chicken. And they said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to animals, every man is a Nazi. So he had a very strong position. Now, I know that that offended enormously other survivors who felt that it's not right to compare the Holocaust to animals. And yet, you know, I've been reading a lot of Holocaust literature, and one of the things that strikes me, every single memoir I've ever read, there is a phrase, they treated us like animals. They treated us like cattle. We were led to the slaughter like sheep. So what occurred to me when I first read that is, well, do these people think it's okay to treat the sheep that way, or is it okay to treat the cattle that way? Surely it should follow that if this is a terrible thing to do to Jews, it's also a terrible thing to do to cattle or to sheep or to chickens. Now, that is not a question that, of course, was being asked during the Holocaust, but there are a lot of Jewish vegans. I'm Jewish. And, you know, we do think about this, and I don't think the Holocaust analogy is inappropriate at all. I think it's a very apt one.
I still think there might be some people offended that you're comparing, you know, animals and people and putting them in the same sort of category.
Sure. Yeah, of course they would. And, you know, I'm not saying they're identical situations, but there are certain analogies that spring to mind. I mean, when you see these trucks going, you see these, you know, railroad cars with the animals in them, you see their eyes staring out, and you see them branded, you know, and they go to these places that are basically death camps. I mean, what other word? We're not going to call them summer camps, right? They don't come back from them. So I don't think it's totally inappropriate. It doesn't mean it's identical. It just means that studying the Holocaust can give you certain insights just to slavery. I mean, the great slave historian Brian Davis has made the analogy with domesticated animals. He said, you know, I can't help but see tremendous similarities between the way slaves were treated and the way domestic animals are still treated today.
Jeffrey Mason's new book is The Face on Your Plate, The Truth About Food. Jeffrey, thanks very much for being with us.
It was a pleasure, Deborah.
Next week on Here and Now, how do you negotiate a severance package in a bad economy? Also, the movies that helped shape Larry King, Newt Gingrich, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson. That's next week, back after the news, Here and Now. Question. Do you know who wrote this about the world's most famous chestnut tree? Quote, "From my favorite spot on the floor, I look up at the blue sky and the bare chestnut tree, on whose branches little raindrops shine, appearing like silver, and at the seagulls and other birds as they glide on the wind." Well, that was written by Anne Frank in her diary on February 23, 1944. Anne Frank relied on that chestnut tree to measure the passing seasons during the 2 years she spent in Amsterdam hiding from Nazis, and soon saplings grown from that tree will be brought to the United States. And the group with the saplings is looking for takers. Yvonne Simons is executive director of the Anne Frank Center USA, which is based in New York City. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about this original chestnut tree that's still standing outside of Anne Frank's hideout. What do you think the tree meant to her, and what kind of condition is it in now?
It's a gigantic, beautiful tree. And for her, it was the only little outlook on what was going on around her and growth and the change of seasons. And basically, she could only see a little bit of the tree and the Westerkerk on the other side of the house. So this is straight from the attic. It is an ailing tree, and there have been a number of lawsuits in 2006 and 2007 going back and forth between taking it down and leaving it on. And there was an enormous outcry across the world, really, to keep that tree standing, because of what it meant to Anne Frank and what it symbolizes, basically, which is human resilience. As a result, after the last lawsuit that was brought against the city of Amsterdam, basically, the Anne Frank house and the city decided that they would keep it, and it is in a harness today. But it is really ailing, and it is a dying tree. So what the Anne Frank house in Amsterdam decided is that they will spread little saplings all across the world, and as you mentioned, 10 of them will come to the United States.
So it's being held up structurally right now because it's a very sick tree. Some folks, it's not really known for sure, but some folks believe it's about 150 years old, isn't that right?
That's about right, yes.
And so they've got these 10 saplings that they've taken from the original tree that will be planted in the United States. How did those saplings get to you?
Well, we are a partner to the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, and as such, they have promised us the 10 saplings. They had hoped to have them all planted on what would have been our 80th birthday this coming June 12th. However, the saplings are prohibited from traveling in the spring, so therefore they will come to me in the fall starting October. We have a couple of places we really would like to have them grow. One of them would be the White House. We think that an administration that really has this concept of hope in their mission, and certainly that dovetails with ours, is a place where we would love to have this sapling grow. Another one would be the Indianapolis Museum. They have a major exhibit on Anne Frank. And in addition, we would love to go to the 9/11 Memorial Museum down here in Manhattan, which is a couple of blocks away of where we are located.
So that's three, and you've got 10. What do you
do?
That's
right.
What do you do with the other seven?
The remaining seven, we hope to issue an RFP on June 12th, and people can go to our website for that. And we really are looking for organizations that have tolerance in their mission. Basically, we want to see what's out there, who has great ideas, and we are open to all kinds of concepts as long as it is some kind of a tolerance, and teaching about the consequences of intolerance is tied to this.
Would location matter? Is there a particular area of the country where a chestnut tree would thrive better than in other areas?
We have all those questions into some of the agricultural organizations in this country right now, but it's going to be part of the RFP. Obviously, there may be spots in this country where the tree would not flourish.
So when would you make a decision then, do you think?
I think the decision will be made by the end of July, so that the people have a couple of months to arrange for everything to arrive and then have it planted in the fall.
Yvonne Simons is executive director of the Anne Frank Center USA in New York City. And next, why did so many economists miss the recession until we were in it? You're listening to Here and Now. There's more grim economic reports out today, but grim might be a relative term. The Commerce Department reported that demand for durable goods fell in March. And in the automobile industry, the Treasury Department now says that General Motors has been given an additional $2 billion in federal loans. The government's also asking Chrysler to prepare a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing as soon as next week. And the Ford Motor Company today reported a huge first quarter loss. But again, Ford's numbers weren't as bad as expected, and that's what we want to focus on now, those expectations. Who's doing the expecting, and why do we often hear that things are either better or worse than analysts expected? Do we ever hear that the analysts got it right? Our guest is Peter Coy. He's the economics editor for Business Week magazine, and he has a cover story this week titled, What Good Are Economists Anyway? And Peter, we'll get to the topic of your article in a moment, but first, what do you make of today's numbers?
Expectations are, as you said, critically important. So let's just go to Ford for a second. You emphasized the negative, which is that they did post a big first quarter loss. But the market is focusing on the positive, which is that the loss was less than expected. So the stock is up. The market is up on this news. Somebody was quoted saying this is a fantastic performance. Isn't it kind of strange? You can lose a lot of money and have people tell you it's a fantastic performance. Some other company like Google, if it doesn't make gigantic amounts of money, it's seen as a terrible performance. And then the durable goods orders number you mentioned, again, a bad number, and yet we're in a recession, so it was not as bad as expected. And that's kind of the theme of my story, is that this mirrors within mirrors of what economic forecasting is all about.
Yeah, well, so let's talk about some of that. When we hear these little reports today, and we can say that the Ford Motor Company reports a $1.4 billion loss, but hey, that's okay because it's actually better than what we thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Why did we think it was going to be so bad, and why did we get it wrong to think that it was going to be so bad?
Right. So my article, you know, says right up front that economists are only human. They cannot be expected to foretell the future. If they could, with any accuracy, they'd all be, you know, living on islands. Their own islands, that is, and yet they hold themselves out, and this is the criticism, to A, be able to send up warning flags when there's trouble ahead, and B, to tell us when we get into a deep economic crisis like the one we're in now, how to climb out of it. So I fault them, A, for not really putting up enough warning flags. I'm talking about the profession as a whole. Certainly there were some people who did see trouble coming and spoke out about it. But, you know, looking at the consensus forecast, they were predicting, you know, growth in the fourth quarter when we actually ended up having the worst performance in a quarter century. And then looking ahead, there's no consensus about what to do next. You know, a lot of people favor sort of Keynesian stimulus, which is, you know, reasonable. And that, in fact, is what the government seems to be doing. And yet there's another substantial camp of people who say that would be folly, that all that would do is succeed in driving up the budget deficit and the national debt and waste a lot of money.
So on the one hand, you have the folks who say the Obama administration is getting it right, is doing the right thing in terms of providing this stimulus money. And on the other side, you have folks saying, you know, the economy is really more self-equilibrating and
right.
we shouldn't be doing this at all.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And so they can't come to an agreement here. And so here we are not really knowing how to go forward.
What we need is a one-handed economics profession. So it can't say on the one hand this, on the other hand that. Back in January, before Obama took office, he gave a speech in which he said, and he probably was saying this without fear of contradiction, that everybody agrees that we need to take drastic action now to, you know, stop this downward spiral. And a bunch of economists sponsored by the Cato Institute, the libertarian organization, and this is over 250 economists, including a number of Nobel Prize winners, said, with all due respect, Mr. President, we disagree. They said, no, we don't think that the government should be stepping in a major interventionist way. And, you know, the truth is what they were saying actually reflected the conventional wisdom, which is that fiscal stimulus is not effective. And it's only now, after monetary policy has failed to get us out of this, that economists are sort of grudgingly coming around to the idea that, hey, maybe we do need to spend a lot of money. And there's a lot of debate out there. And that's really, if you sum it up, that's my main criticism, is that can't these guys, you know, agree on anything? We need them to agree so that they can provide useful guidance to policymakers who are not economists.
And this has been going on throughout economics history, if you will. Isn't that right?
Well, economics history is really not even that long, because economics didn't really emerge as a separate, you know, course of study really until, I would say, the 20th century. Up until then, it was considered sort of politics and so on. And a lot of people think maybe we made a mistake by trying to carve it out as being a real science on its own.
But there is still disagreement among economists now as to big economic events like the Great Depression.
Exactly. You know, that happened 70 years ago, and you would think that by now they would have sort of worked out what happened, but you can go to conferences now where people say, you know, the New Deal was a folly, it was a huge mistake, and all it did was prolong things. I wouldn't say that's the majority opinion, but the fact that so many people still believe it after all these years just goes to show how there's been no success at reaching agreement. It's as if astronomers were still disagreeing about whether the Earth goes around the sun or vice versa.
But what about the science of economics here? I mean, you actually quote someone who writes on a blog. Why did economists do a worse job forecasting the housing market collapse than his uneducated parents? That's what one blogger wrote that you quote in your article. And I think that's a question here. I mean, these trained people aren't getting it right.
Economics is not a science in the way physics is a science. You know, physics, force equals mass times acceleration, and that's that, end of story. With economics, there are so many things that go into it. There's so many human elements. And economists, in order to have a sort of tractable economic model, try to abstract from the complexities of the situation. You know, they had the classic Homo economicus, this fictional being who performed completely logically at all times, was omniscient and unemotional. And it was just an unrealistic portrayal of the human condition, and it didn't allow for things like the sort of bubbles that we had. The bubble in housing was all about emotion and greed and all those very human characteristics that just weren't in the models.
Some might have to wonder, maybe not as exact a science as physics, but certainly a study of economic behavior nonetheless. How did we not factor in the human issues, if you will, into our economic forecasts? And how is it that someone like former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan could deny that, you know, a national housing bubble was going to happen and not account for those human factors?
I think it goes back to their training and their mindset. And people call it physics envy sometimes, this idea that you pretend to a higher level of authority than you really can achieve.
So do you think that we will see a more unified vision from economists in the future? Will business schools change or economics departments change?
I think it has to. You know, Deb, that's a good question. And I think there's some introspection going on here. For one thing, there's almost universal agreement now that economists understudied the financial sector, underappreciated its role in the current turbulence. So that'll be a positive. But whether they'll go all the way to reaching a consensus, that I would not expect.
So we'll still ask, what good are economists anyway?
It remains a good question.
All right. Thanks very much, Peter.
All right. Thank you.
Peter Coy is economics editor for Business Week magazine. And before we go today, a tour of an art installation in Detroit, and it's not in a museum, it's on the street. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Detroit used to be synonymous with the auto industry. These days, though, the city's a symbol of urban decline instead of manufacturing prowess. Car lots are full of unsold vehicles, thousands of jobs have been lost, and many houses sit empty. Tyree Guyton is a lifelong resident of Detroit who's determined to do something to help his city. He's fighting back with art. For several years, he's been decorating vacant houses with colorful junk, stuff that other residents have thrown away. Known as the Heidelberg Project, Guyton's art now covers more than two city blocks. The BBC's Chris McCarris takes a tour.
I've come to the east side of Detroit, about a mile north of the Detroit River and Canada. It's an area of the city which is particularly abandoned and burned out and empty of people and homes because many have been torn down. But Tyree Guyton, who's in his 50s, has been for the last 23 years making art out of recycled, discarded objects. One of the collections of art here is a pile of about 100 shoes.
The people that wore these shoes, and if these shoes could talk, what would they say? So what I see here with these shoes, I see lots and lots of stories, people, life, the journey.
On two different occasions, the city council decided to come and destroy the art that Tyree had been working on for years.
One thing that they said to me that really stands out, they said art belongs in an institution. The first demolition, 1991, they took away 80% of this project. Came here and just took it away.
They loaded it up on trucks?
Oh, they came here with bulldozers and they demolished houses that were standing during that time and artwork that was in vacant lots. I was so angry. But you know what came to me is that I had to take that frustration, that anger, and I had to do something very positive with it. Art is so powerful, you can't get rid of it. It came back. And it keeps coming back, even greater than before.
Art. Is it really a catalyst for change? The answer is yes, it is.
Janine Whitfield is Tyree Guyton's wife.
We've proven it, and now we can prove it more around the country and the world.
Janine right now is trying to coordinate the arrival of 200 kids coming from Wayne County Community College. They're honor students, and they're learning about community revitalization.
We can just stay in kind of a tight group. We're going to walk over this way.
The Heidelberg Project got its first volunteer tour guides, and one of them is Stephen Gatens.
I guess we'll just go right into it. One of the first pieces we have here is Doors of Opportunity. Heidelberg Street, there's like one, two, three, four different entrances to it. And you're going to see these structures all around. Some of the significance behind it is there's many doors in life. Some are open, some are closed. And we want to show that here at the Heidelberg Project, the doors are always open.
Another group of students is being led by Courtney Wise. She's 24 years old. She was born and raised in a neighborhood that looks a lot like this one, but it doesn't have the art. She's showing the students a tree with dozens of shoes hanging from the branches.
And so Tyree asked his grandfather, do you remember lynchings happen? He said, yes. said, "What, could you see the bodies?" He said, "No, I couldn't see the bodies, but I could see the soles. I could see the soles of their shoes." So this is kind of a two-part homage to those people who died for nothing, lynched in trees, and his grandfather could see the soles of their feet. But now it also means something much greater and much better than that, much more hopeful. Now we aren't just lynching people, we're lifting the souls of people to the Most High. We are lifting humanity together, and that's what we see now.
We're going to walk over to a house. It's called the Dadi Wadi House. That's been in Tyree Guyton's family for about 50 years. Let's have Zena Maroof just do a listing of all the things that you can see, just on this one house.
All right, you see a lot of polka dots, all connected, all different colors, different sizes. There's a portrait of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the porch and also on the ceiling of the porch. There are chairs, there are little models of the House That Makes Sense that has, they're all covered in pennies, and that's part of a pilot project of the Heidelberg Project. I see a traffic signal over there that's obviously not working, but here on Heidelberg Street it serves a new purpose.
What do you think that purpose is?
Well, it's not trash anymore. It's now a new, it's a piece of art.
Did you get the pennies?
Yeah, here you go.
Brandon Gatson is 26 years old, and he grew up in this neighborhood. And he's been coming to the Heidelberg Project for years just to get inspiration.
This poem is actually dedicated to the Heidelberg Project. It's entitled Teardrops. Who will cry for the mothers whose sons and daughters feel victim to the genocide of drive-bys and suicides? Will they be accompanied in their suffrage by others? Who will mourn for their losses, or will they be alone in their sorrow? Will they be like the countless who were robbed from their homeland for the fatal voyage across the Atlantic? Who's gonna cry for the numerous hung and lynched in honor of feasts you now call picnics, as a so-called nigger was picked and dangled in the trees like piñatas by inhumane, sadistic slave masters in the name of celebration? Will teardrops fall for the families of the missing soldiers who never made it home? And what about the soldiers who remain unknown because their remains were never recovered? And it's like that tree speaks to that, and the pieces on Tim House speaks to that. And then the Faces of God speaks to that. It speaks about that as well. The Heidelberg Project is like a cry out for change. And that's what it does. It lets you see change. It lets you see that this is all stuff that people thought was junk. And then it just gives you a whole different perception of it, because now it's art.
About 25 years ago, Tyree Guyton was a student at the College of Creative Studies here in Detroit. And he dropped out. Professors had told him that he doesn't really have the stuff to be a great student. And in May, he will receive an honorary doctorate from that same school for the work he's done here in Detroit.
The biggest message, one of my favorite messages about Heidelberg Project, is a feeling of proactiveness, doing something. Just pick up some of the discarded remnants and breathe new life and make it better.
A change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
The BBC's Chris McHarris in Detroit.
I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
A change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.